Hello, and welcome to Securing Sexuality, the podcast where we discuss the intersection of intimacy
and information security. I'm Wolf Gorlick.
He's a hacker, and I'm Stephanie Gorlick.
She is a sex therapist, and together we're going to discuss what safe sex looks like in the digital age.
And today we are joined by Maya Brooks. Maya, I have been super excited to talk to you. Wolf, tell me a little bit more about Maya.
So, Maya is an award-winning product manager, educator, speaker, entrepreneur, which I love having entrepreneurs in this space on this podcast to talk with, based in New York City, ex-financial analyst turned web developer turned product manager, and I've very rarely seen that path, so I love that, focusing on the intersection of fintech and edtech. And then here's another part from a tech perspective that just gets me excited. Focused in on Privy Photos and Privy Labs, a blockchain-enabled platform to protect content leaks and abuse, which is, of course, exactly where we're going today. But one last thing, co-organizer of Blockchain New York City, the largest meetup of blockchain enthusiasts, 100,000 members. I thought I was doing good, like 1,000 hackers, 100,000 members. So good to have you with us, Maya.
Stephanie Wolf, thank you so much for having me. And we're 10,000 actually at Blockchain NYC, so I don't want to take extra credit for 100,000. That would be an insane amount of people we need to corral. But thank you all both for having me. I'm really excited.
So let's start with the privacy side. Let's start with the consent-based internet, right? That's sort of like, in my understanding, the beginning point. How do we unwind what we've built? And I've looked at the internet for so long, and I loved the openness and the frictionless way of sharing data. But of course, as we've all know and have we realized in the past couple of decades, that has some real downsides when it comes to consent and privacy.
Definitely. And I love starting off with that question. So to speak just a little bit about, you know, the way that I've been thinking about this for the last few years. I come from the BDSM world. I've been involved in the BDSM communities in New York for over 8 years. And consent is a main topic, not only just in that community, but now starting to become, thankfully, a broader topic in all sexual interactions. And I always felt that the types of things you learn from the BDSM community about consent really should be broadly applied to almost every facet of our life. You know, everything from how we talk to each other to how we interact with each other in relationships, what we share on the internet and what we don't, how a company should have access to us and how they don't. And those are just, you know, tenets of kind of my core belief system. So when it came time to build what we're now calling Privy Labs, one of the main things we really wanted to focus on was kind of a categorization of all of us, every single one of us who uses the internet every single day, basically as a contributor to the internet. And because we're all contributors to this internet and we make up kind of this broad fabric of things that exist, right? Websites and pages and clicks and photos and media links and all of the things that we put out on the internet every day, that we should have some say on exactly what happens to that information, what happens to that piece of media that you share with some company who then decides to put it on its server and then mine it for information and then sell that information to another company. There are so many kind of additional steps that we as contributors to the internet are often not privy to, or not really upfront opt-in consenting to as we use the internet. And so the way we define kind of a consent-based internet is really being able to have a 100% user-owned, a 100% contributor-owned internet in which you have full end-to-end ownership of every single piece of information that you share about yourself on the internet. And I think us and a few other companies are really starting to make waves, make headways in that type of thinking.
You know, Maya, my area of professional expertise is BDSM kink and mental health. And I'm actually in 9 days now, it's officially a single digit countdown, teaching a workshop here in Detroit called Becoming a Boundaries Bitch. That is basically, it's consent and boundary setting.
I love that.
So everything you're saying, I love this. And one of the things that I find myself talking about a lot in my own practice is this idea of informed consent. And not just informed consent around, you know, what are the risks of, I don't know, mummification play, but what are the risks in your dating profiles? What are your risks on your kinky social media? What are the agreements that you're forming in your relationships before you co-parent or buy a house together or get married? You know, informed consent at all layers and levels of the relationship. And the language of BDSM, I think, is really lovely for that. And I'm curious how your experience in the community has informed your work in technology.
Definitely. And that's a really great jumping off point. I love that you said that, Stephanie. You know, my experience in the BDSM community, and I haven't shared much on a public podcast about this yet, so I guess you'll be my first. But this... when I first got into BDSM, I didn't realize how often I actually never really said no in a relationship or no even in a work setting, in personal relationships. I just never really said the word no, like almost ever. And it became really, really a great exercise for me, extremely empowering to me, using and being kind of armed with the language that you get from being active in the BDSM community around setting your own boundaries, the boundaries that are personal to you, agreeing upfront, like, I would like to do these things. I would not like to do these things. I'm open to these things. I'm interested in these things. I'm into that, or I'm not into that. Those are words I'd never used in any encounter in my life prior to that period. And when I reflected on that, like, I felt a little bit sad for myself. Like, that's kind of sad. I've just been kind of going with the flow in my own life for the last, you know, however many years. And to find a place where I felt like it was not only the encouragement, but the expectation that everyone would be communicating on that same level was so freeing, so empowering. And I really think that the broader public has so much to learn from the BDSM community in that regard. And I think us as technologists, we have a lot to learn, especially as privacy technologists, a lot to learn from that type of language. And I think organizations that are leading the way in privacy are very much aligned with, you know, user-informed consent, not just opt out stuff, but like full opt-in. And I think that setting up those tenets is really important to making technology that is not exploitative of its users. And I don't think that technology needs to be exploitative of users in order to generate value or to generate profit or generate returns. And I think that there's a little bit of like a mismatch that's kind of been happening around, you know, the language we use to describe, like, oh, selling user data or mining user data. And I'm like, I think there's a lot of ways to get information out of people. And sometimes you'll find if you just ask and allow them to tell you what they want to tell you, they might actually speak, but you have to make space for them to do that. And I think we just have a lot to learn there.
That has been one of the things that I have said for years, that I think the mainstream or vanilla community could learn so much about just how kinky people talk about consent. And I love that you say, you know, if you just ask, sometimes you'll get more than you even expected. And it's true. And I think in technology, you know, we have these incredibly dense TOS or these just little formative click here to accept all, and you don't even know what you're accepting. When if it were a no, seriously, we want you to click through and tell us what you want us to have, I suspect more people would click more boxes than if it were somehow just the simple yes no binary that it is right now.
I agree. And you know, the first inkling that I really got of people utilizing this language properly, or starting to at least have conversations in their daily lives that involved consent practices or consent frameworks, was around the pandemic. And people really vocalizing, like, hey, our home has these rules. If you do not have, you know, these things, please join us at the next event, but don't come to my home, you know, if you don't meet these requirements. Or like, I need to know, like, I've been testing on this day. Have you been testing on this day? And that was the first time I've really seen the broader public actually adopt a lot of that language. And it was really nice to see. And I hope it's a habit that sticks.
It's good to see something good come out of that shared experience we just went through.
Yeah.
In the tech space, it oftentimes seems, you know, Stephanie, you brought up terms of service, of course, clink wrapped or shrink wrapped licensing. It often seems like there's a big disconnect between how consent conversations go and how the technology is actually instrumented.
Mm-hmm.
In what ways is technology like letting us down or prohibiting us from having these consent conversations with how our data and our information and our content is used?
That's a great question, Wolf. I think in a couple of ways. One challenge in making sure that users are fully informed of what they're signing up for when they're using your technology is working on the actual UI and UX of that process. So how easy is it for the user to read and digest this information? Are the buttons bright and big? Is the text and the type large and big so that people actually understand that this is a core part of the process, not some small print, some small font that you're just supposed to skip past? And really building it into something that users must complete before they use the product, I think is going to be extremely necessary as we continue to build. The other portions, and I'm also curious to know, you know, what you all are both seeing, is kind of the mishandling or misuse or, you know, lower level of security that actually happens on the back end server side for a lot of information. And then the ability or chance, the opportunity for the government to overreach into those systems. I'll give a great example from a company that I was actually, you know, I follow for a while and have been listening to their CEO speak for a little bit and their members of their trust and safety team. But Grindr, right? Grindr is like a really great example of this. And so are all kind of dating companies, modern, you know, dating companies. People have given their information, they've attached a profile, a face, right? Some identifying information, which might include their real name, their, you know, age, their date of birth, all of this kind of like really heavy material, you know, PII. And those profiles, while other users on the internet may not be farming that information, if you have a government that is against queer rights, against the LGBTQ community, and wants to reach in by saying, hey, this person has violated something, a lot of companies are kind of allowing this back door for the government to come in and say, like, actually, we can subpoena this information from said company. There are very few companies that have turned down that back door from the government. And built full end-to-end encryption on every single piece of their technology. You know, Apple prides itself on saying no to that kind of like backdoor from the government. But there are several other companies who have made it clear that they'll comply if asked. And depending on the, you know, nation state that you live in, that may or may not be very, very dangerous for you as a user. I think, you know, even now in the US, we're seeing with the overturn of Roe v. Wade, the amount of health information that could potentially be leaked from some health app that might be later used against women and people who have the ability to get pregnant. Against them in a case of a miscarriage or an abortion or anything else that could happen in the complication of birth. And having that information used against them. So there's a really broad swath of education that needs to happen on the consumer side, but also a lot of shoring up of end-to-end encryption, encrypted servers, encrypted technology. And I think personally, zero knowledge technology, which has some, you know, blockchain underpinnings there, in order to really fortify a lot of those applications moving forward.
So it's funny that you mentioned the backdoors in the systems and health apps. We, months ago, I think last fall, interviewed Albert Fox Kahn, who's the founder of the Surveillance Technology Oversight Project, which is also based in New York by you. And just today, they released a report on state surveillance of gender-affirming care and reproductive health care and how that data collection process is being weaponized and used by law enforcement. And I think that that is something that people have become, unfortunately and necessarily, more aware of since Dobbs fell last year. But I'm curious, besides like the social media backdoors, besides the ways in which information is subpoenaable or discoverable, what are some other ways that people's privacy get compromised that they might not think about? Are there things that people are doing themselves that are exposing themselves or putting them at risk?
A large percentage, and it depends on, you know, which industry you're operating in, but I think that there's kind of like three main like ways that people's privacy really gets compromised in any technology information. One is, you know, user error, mistrust, clicking on a phishing email, clicking on a spam link, you know, clicking something that has made it into your inbox or has made it into your text messages, and someone, you know, has falsely included some harmful information in there, and kind of granting an exploit that way. I think that that is still a pretty wide majority of a lot of the things that we see in cybersecurity in terms of exploits. And Wolf, I'm happy to, if you have any stats there, I'm happy to take you throwing them out. But I think that's a pretty large bucket. The second bucket is company exploits, server-side hacks, cloud exploits, people, you know, an actual hacker, a bad guy, you know, writing code that is designed to find a hole in the security system and then exploit it. And then the last is kind of this, like, we're in a murky gray situation. The government thinks something is illegal, wants to kind of like reach in and find something that they should, that technically the company has said is private between the user and the company. Those are kind of the main ways that I see people's privacy get compromised every single day. And I think often we do ourselves a disservice by talking about cybersecurity as if it's all like a bad guy, like some bad hacker from a movie in like, you know, dark glasses and like a hat, and not often like sometimes other people, right? Other people can present a really big risk to us, especially, you know, for the user group that I work with, in terms of, you know, creators, people who sell and monetize content, people who are in the sex work field, and are, you know, tasked with, unfortunately, vetting their own, you know, clients, vetting, you know, people who may or may not pose harm to them, and trying to determine whether or not this person is sending them real information, real links, et cetera, and trying to rely on the company to help. And that is it's a really difficult place to be in.
You know, from a statistics perspective, you'll see numbers 80 to 90% of security incidents are caused by some of the items you just highlighted. And a while back, I was reading The Design of Everyday Things. I think Stephanie gave me this book by Diane Norman. She's like, I want you to talk about something other than technology. So, of course, I immediately applied it to all of my technology things. But there's a quote in there that said that 80 to 90% of industrial accidents are caused by human beings. And then he ends the page. Why is that? And I flip the page. I'm ready. I'm like, I saw the statistic on, you know, this website recently. I've seen this presentation. We know this is what happens. And I flip the page and Don Norman goes, it isn't a human problem. It's a design problem.
Mm.
And I'm like, flip back. I'm like, wait a minute. No, you can't tell me it's me. Don't tell me it's my fault. And that was really eye-opening. And I think about how often people make mistakes these days.
Yeah.
And I ask myself, how has the design of technology let them down? And I know this is something you are doing a lot with Privy Labs, right? So can you talk us through how technology could better support consent and privacy?
What we're building at Privy Labs is really about changing kind of the fabric of the internet. And definitely consider myself a blockchain girly. And I know that crypto gets a bad rap and, you know, blockchain gets a bad rap, but I beg the audience here to go with me on this journey for just a second, which is that blockchain is one of those technologies, distributed ledger technology is one of those technologies we really have at our disposal to provide two really key things. A, self-custody of your own information. So you as the user, Wolf, of some application get to decide the entire way through what your information does. And having the ability to self-custody your own information through some wallet infrastructure is extremely important. It is a major technological breakthrough and one of the things that I think will underpin the internet for, you know, the years to come. And then the second is zero knowledge activity and zero knowledge authentication. Being able to provide your identity in a safe and secure way to a company without the company seeing that information. All the company knows is, yes, Wolf is over the age of 18, but I don't, and that information has been verified by an agency. But the company doesn't need your government ID. They don't need your license and they don't need all this other information about you, right? They just need to know that like the check turned out true. And that type of technology, I think, is going to be critically important infrastructure-wise to making sure that people, especially people in marginalized or underrepresented groups, can continue to access the internet in a way that's safe for them. If there is anything that you feel is, you know, open to exploit by another person and also by our government, you want to support the development and the use of underlying blockchain infrastructure in every single major tech company that we move forward with. And we've built Privy personally in a really privacy preserving manner in order to make sure that we can offer those promises to people who get on our platform. And there's a lot that we built in to do that, and I'm happy to go into it.
Okay, so I want to jump in as the resident non-technical person. And I think it's been a couple episodes since I've gotten to say that. When I hear blockchain, I think of people buying digital art.
Oh, art, okay.
The NFTs. I think of cartoon monkeys being sold for millions. It seems like a right click makes this way less cool, but I don't know. So help me understand as much as you can. Talk to me as if I were a third grader.
Yeah.
What the hell is blockchain, Maya? Because everybody talks about it. It's just like burst into the collective consciousness and everybody acts as if we know what it is. And I think maybe 5 or 10 people do, but most of us do not. And I am one of those that uses the word blockchain, have no idea what I'm talking about. What is the blockchain?
I love that question, Stephanie. And I'm gonna do my best. Let me know if this is not helping. But for you and everyone listening, I'm going to start off with the umbrella term Web3. I do think that Andreessen Horowitz, you know, for all of the things we critique them on, did a great job rebranding the next version of kind of the internet. If you think about the current version of the internet that we're in now, or I'll even go back to the version before this, when the internet first launched into like public consciousness, let's call it generally the 90s, mostly what people were doing with the internet then was just reading information. You know, people weren't like writing information on the internet. Maybe there were like a few blogs back in the day, but it really hadn't like taken off. Mostly you went to the internet because you wanted to read something someone wrote or like access some website of like the store that you want to go to down the street and you want to see if they were open, right? Like a lot of the information that you're doing was just reading, consuming information. Web 2 is kind of where we are now in the internet landscape and internet history where, you know, starting from the early 2000s all the way till I would say like around 2018 or so, what you have is kind of a real fabric of the internet starting to form where we as, you know, people who access the internet actually put stuff on the internet, like content and media and images and videos, and we make streaming services, and we make web apps, and we make social media sites like Facebook, and we write blogs, and we contribute with each other, and the internet kind of like exponentially gets more and more complex, broader, larger, deeper, and we really focus on kind of like how each of us uses the internet and also gets to experience the internet in a really unique way, right? Stephanie, whatever you see on your feed every day in Google is probably super different than what I see on my feed every day, because it's tailored to you, right? So that's kind of where we are right now, Web 2, and that's where we've been for like the last 15 or so years. And Web 3 is really our ability to not only read stuff from the internet and write stuff, publish stuff on the internet broadly, but also to own our own information on the internet. And so when we say like a user-owned internet, that's really where we are with Web3, where you own your own data. Think about it kind of like a little tunnel where you're like traveling through the internet, but all your information is in your tunnel. And you get to take your tunnel like wherever you want to take it, and nobody should get in your tunnel or see what's in your tunnel unless you grant them access. And so there's a version kind of the internet that's really starting to take shape in the Web3 space. Now, under the Web3 space, I think there are lots of applications of blockchain technology that enable us to engage with a couple of different products. NFTs, the digital art, is one of them, right? Like, okay, we can generate this kind of like digital art from some algorithm, and we can put cool traits in it, and then people can decide its value, and maybe they can trade it or use it or license it or whatever. That's one use of an application that is available because of blockchain technology. Number two is like cryptocurrencies, right? Okay, well, if we have this user-owned internet where we all can do our own thing and then put out whatever we want to put out, we could have kind of a decentralized currency, right? One that isn't centralized in some central bank, but actually, you know, mined and created and driven by an algorithm. And if we have this algorithmic coin thing, then maybe we can do stuff with that. We can trade it, we can hold it, we can invest it, whatever we want to do, right? So these applications kind of different things that have now become like crypto and NFTs and lots of stuff, all I think kind of sit under the big umbrella of Web3. I feel like that was longer than it was supposed to be, but is that helpful?
It is helpful. Although now in my head, the mental image is not like a chain link. Now it's a tunnel.
Yeah, like a tunnel.
So my metaphor has changed.
Yeah.
I'm wrapping my head around it. Get there. By the time Web 4 or Web 5 hits, definitely by Web 6, I'll have wrapped my head around Web 3.
We'll let our tunnel kind of like make it something. I mean, I think the chain link metaphor is an interesting one, but it speaks more about like what a smart contract is than like what Web 3, I think, broadly is, right? Like a smart contract allows you to like have two pieces of information in a contract. And when some criteria is met, you automatically execute the contract. Nobody gets asked. It's not an operation that takes humans to decide on should we execute the thing. The thing gets executed because the criteria was agreed to. And because of that, we feel like it's more decentralized. And when that smart contract criteria is sometimes agreed to, depending on where you're applying it, that's where you get the kind of like, okay, add this new chain to the block or add this new block to the chain and generate some other blank. But I really feel like that whole metaphor does a disservice to most people who are like, I don't need to know how smart contracts necessarily work. Like, I just need to know why, what am I getting by using blockchain technology? And I think for most users, what they're getting by utilizing blockchain technology or engaging with companies that properly use blockchain technology is a little bit more ownership, a little bit more self-custody, a little bit more safety, because if you have a company that never sees your information in the first place, no one can exploit it, right? No one can exploit, let's say I have a company called Kitchen
and the kitchen wants to know if you are over the age of 18, Stephanie. The kitchen doesn't need your ID and a bunch of other information in order to know that, to figure out that you are a real person who's over the age of 18 and should be eligible to use this service, right? They're going to use kind of like a complex rhythm and algorithm of a bunch of different functions, cryptographic functions, to prove that that information is true. But they don't need your actual information. And that's really, really powerful, because if some government one day says, hey, kitchen, I need you to turn over all of Stephanie's information, then they have nothing to turn over. There's just nothing there. You know, there's just proofs that say, yes, 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 yes. That's it. So it becomes really, really important for any application or any use case, any person who wants to protect their individual information.
And I think that's the benefit of a zero knowledge proof, right? Tying it back. But you said something interesting there. There's two things that I think technologists always get wrong. And the first is, we get so excited about the technology, we forget why anyone cares. So you're spot on. Like, if I was to talk to someone, I'd be like, hey, do you want a more private, more you-centric internet? People say, sure. If I was to say, let me tell you about smart contracts, they would get that look that Stephanie often gets when I try to explain to her toaster technology. But the other thing that we oftentimes get wrong is, one use case of technology will happen that we don't like, and suddenly we don't like the technology at all.
Right.
So it's clearly a lot of exploration in some of these Web3 technologies have taken us down paths that we're not happy with. But that doesn't necessarily mean we quit. And we, like, as if we said, well, MySpace, I didn't like that, so let's forget all about Web 2.0. I think there's a lot of good tech to build on. So I'm glad you surfaced that. So if someone wants to partner with you, or if someone's building an application or building a set of services, I mean, how do they get involved with what you got going on at Privy Labs?
Privy Labs is an open source community, open source project. We're really proud of a lot of the technology we've built thus far. We actually released our very first consumer-facing app built on top of the Privy Labs protocol, which is a decentralized and sophisticated anti-piracy protocol that helps creators protect their content from leaks, abuse, misuse. And we have a few systems that we've built on top of our protocol. We are going to be open sourcing and continuing to put out projects that fit the criteria of a user-owned internet where creators are really empowered to own their own content. And if you're interested in that, visit us at privylabs.xyz. That's privylabs, P-R-I-V-Y-L-A-B-S .xyz. .xyz. And come visit us there. And there's lots of information on how to get involved with us, with our team, and with our project. And one of the things that we're really proud of is our commitment to the developer community and to making as much as possible available to our fellow developers so that they can, you know, participate with us in making this next version of the internet.
And we'll throw that link in there. I'm so glad it's open source, because, you know, when it comes to community and when it comes to trying to keep things safe, there's so much benefits that can be gleaned by sharing what we know, by providing sunlight into our code, which has me asking one quick question, Stephanie, if I can just sneak one question in, one more tech question. What do you do to make sure that Privy itself is secure?
That's a great question. So it really started with our architecture and the way that we've specifically built Privy and then built consumer apps on top of it. So we have three kind of core systems. We have an account abstraction system, which allows users to access the Privy Cam, our consumer app, app without sharing personal information. So all it requires is a username and password. We don't need your email, just a username and password. You then, you know, keep that secure information. We do not store that information on behalf of you. So there's a little bit of a of an implication there as well, which means like we can't reset it if you happen to lose it. So write it down, and we've built into, you know, our onboarding process, like write down this information, don't lose it. But there's no long seed phrase or like phrase for people to memorize when they use PrivyCam. They just use their username and their password and log in. Second, we have a content certificate and tracking system. And we also explain quite a bit about each of our systems in our white paper. So if anyone is interested in reading that information and learning a little bit more about how our systems work, more than welcome. But basically, we developed this second system to secure media content, like an image file, and encrypt it, but also add an irremovable watermark onto that particular photo so that it can be traced across the internet solely by the information that we've embedded inside of it without revealing what the actual image itself is. It's really powerful, especially if you're creating imagery that might be explicit or sensitive and you don't want to reveal exactly what's in that photo. You'll have full comfort and knowledge knowing that Privy not only encrypts, but we transform and do, you know, all of these different methods on that image to make sure that the contents of the image are not revealed. The contents of the image are also not stored on chain. So there's no real way to like decrypt or see the content of that image unless you're the owner of that image. And then we also issue an ownership certificate to each of our creators. So if you're a creator, let's say on Instagram, and you have a photo that you want to prove is 100% yours, you want to store that, like, this is my photo, and maybe not put your name on it and not have that revealed, you'll be able to do both of those things in both a decentralized and encrypted manner to make that happen. So kind of knocking out two of the legs there. And then our last system is still under construction, but essentially it is a verification network where our goal and what we see for the future is kind of that every creator starts contributing content to this verification network. So now you have, you know, photos verified by real people in real time saying like, these are real originals of pieces of content floating out here on the internet. Maybe for images, but also for videos, text, audio, et cetera. Then platforms can plug in and you can make sure that when you want to share your photo forward to Instagram, that you've only shared it to Instagram. Instagram talks back to our verification network and you'll be able to share directly in that network, right? And that piece of content will only be permissioned for the place that you've permissioned it versus every piece of content being permissioned everywhere just by, you know, nature of putting it on some server somewhere. So that's where we're going in the future. And if anyone is interested in joining us on that boat, please come to privylabs.xyz.
And I hope everybody does, because I'm all about safe, lock everything down, informed consent practices in all life domains. But question, as we move towards the end of an amazing conversation, until we do have everyone using Privy or something like Privy, what is one thing that our audience can do to kind of have safer, more secure sex in our digital age?
I love this question. We have a Reddit community, actually, where people ask like questions about sex and sex work and privacy. And this question we get all the time. And our number one answer is always like, get a VPN. I know that a VPN. Yeah. Like I know that like VPNs, they're actually having a moment right now. I feel like they're sponsoring tons of podcasts and, people are getting a little bit more curious as to like what a VPN, a virtual private network is, what it does for you and why it's important. But I would say if you're doing anything on the internet that you might not want other people to know about, or be able to prove, you know, was you later, in the future, get a VPN. It will help protect your traffic, and the, you know, things that you're looking at, from being connected directly to your IP address in your computer. So, get one of those.
I love it. Maya, every time we talk, I feel like we don't have enough time together. I just want to pick your brain about all the things.
I could have chatted for hours.
Thanks for coming on today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you both for having me.
And the nice thing is, anybody that has more questions or that wants to chat with Maya can hang out with her this fall at the Securing Sexuality Conference. So if you want more, Wolfgang, you know where to find her.
I can't wait. I'm so excited.
It's going to be good. Although I will have to let you go. I mean, not only at this podcast, but also at the event, because I'm sure a lot of people will want to learn more about Privy. So thanks again, and thank you so much, dear listener, for tuning into Securing Sexuality, your source of information you need to protect yourself and your relationships.
Securing Sexuality is brought to you by the Bound Together Foundation, a 501c3 nonprofit. From the bedroom to the cloud, we're here to help you navigate safe sex in a digital age.
Be sure to check out our website, securingsexuality.com, for more links to the information we talked about here today. It's in the show notes, as well as our live conference in Detroit. And if you're coming to Detroit, use the code POD15 to save 15% off your tickets.
And join us again for more fascinating conversations about the intersection of sexuality and technology. Have a great week.